Would you like to put your question now that?
Yeah, sure. I don't know if I understood properly the statements made by Aquinas and Aristotle we discussed about yesterday. But it seems to me that there's a kind of dependence of the existence of happiness on the existence of God, divine qualities, the divine, and so on. So I'm asking, let's say for the sake of the argument that we have some proof for the non-existence of God, and at the same time, we have a relation that says something like, the existence of God grounds the existence of happiness. So if God doesn't exist, then happiness doesn't exist. God doesn't exist, then happiness doesn't exist. And this seems to me quite counterintuitive. I don't say false or wrong, but I'm quite reluctant to accept this statement.
I agree with you. I think it is counterintuitive to say that if God doesn't exist, there can be no such thing as happiness. I think certainly I think it's wrong to say that unless you believe that God exists, you can't be happy. I've known quite a lot of happy atheists who seem to me to be not only to regard themselves as happy, but to be living a life which fulfilled Aristotle's requirements for happiness. I'm going on to say something about the relation between morality and the existence of God, which I hope will take further your question. So we are now up to point 15 here. The Peter Geech, who is actually the husband of Elizabeth Anscombe, though he taught at Birmingham University, whereas she taught at Oxford. Peter Geech died a few weeks ago at the age of 95, I think. He accepted the importance of virtue ethics described by Philip of Foot. But he thought that it was only an incomplete account of ethics, unless it was linked to the notion of divine law. I quote from Geech. Somebody might very well admit that not only is there something bad about certain acts, but also it is desirable to become the sort of person who needs to act in the contrary way, and yet not admit that such acts are to be avoided in all circumstances and at any price. To be sure, a virtuous person cannot be ready in advance to do such acts, things forbidden by the commandments and so on. And if he does do them, they will damage his virtuous habits and perhaps wreck his hard-won integrity of soul. But at this point, someone may protest, are you the only person to be considered? Suppose the price of your precious integrity is a most fearful disaster. Haven't you got a hand to burn for your country or for mankind or for your friends? And Geech says this sort of appeal has not been adequately answered on Aristotelian lines, either by Aristotle or by Philip of Foot. And it's at that point, Geech maintains, that the law of God becomes relevant. We must address the question, then, whether God has given laws to humans which forbid whole classes of actions, as human laws do. human reason can readily discern that certain practices like lying, infanticide, adultery, are generally undesirable, even to the point that it's generally desirable that people should not even think of resorting to them. But no general undesirability, sorry, but the general undesirability doesn't rule out possible exceptions in extreme circumstances. But what person is competent judge in his own case to make exception in a particular case? Even apart from bias, our knowledge of the present relevant circumstances is grossly fallible, and still more our knowledge of the future. And Geech maintains that only recognition of a divine law absolutely forbidding certain practices will prevent people making false judgments in the face of difficult temptation. The rational recognition that a certain practice is undesirable and that it's best for people on the whole not even to think of resorting to them is, according to Geech, a promulgation to a man of the divine law forbidding the practice, even if the individual human doesn't realize that it's a promulgation of a divine law, even if he doesn't believe in God. Now, Geech, this seems a bit paradoxical, that somebody who doesn't believe in God should have promulgated to him a divine law. But Geech says this isn't a paradox. Suppose that there is a no parking notice. You have had the law against parking promulgated to you, even if you're under the illusion that you think you can ignore the notice because you think it's been put up by some malicious neighbor who doesn't like your car. And similarly, anyone who can see the general objectionableness of lying and adultery has had God's law promulgated, even if he doesn't recognize it as God's law. Well, I must say, I don't find Geech's argument persuasive. The problem with arguing from what Geech regards as an Aristotelian moral system to a divine law system is not so much a matter of the origin of the precepts, but of their content. As Geech says, you may have had a parking regulation promulgated to you, even if you don't believe the no parking sign was put up by the relevant authority. But I think the parallel with what Geech is claiming is that a notice which says no parking Mondays to Saturdays is promulgation of a law that you may never park there at all. And I think it would be quite unjust for the city council to fine you for parking there on Sundays if the notice had merely said no parking Monday to Saturday. But nonetheless, I agree with Geech that the practice of virtue, the pursuit of virtue, has to be carried out within a framework of absolute moral prohibitions. But I don't think it's true that the Aristotelian system leaves no room for absolute prohibitions. Of course, it's a well-known characteristic of Aristotelian moral virtues that they involve the pursuit of the mean, the right amount of certain actions and emotions. But Aristotle himself tells us that there are some actions and emotions to which the doctrine of the mean does not apply, that there are some actions of which any amount is already too much. He says that while all moral virtues are means of action and passion, it's not the case that every kind of action and passion is capable of a virtuous mean. There are some actions of which there's no right amount because any amount is too much. And Aristotle gives as examples murder and adultery. He says there's no such thing as committing adultery with the right person in the right place and at the right time. And similarly, there are emotions as well as actions which are excluded from the application of the mean. There's no right amount of envy or of spite. Now, the traditional moral systems that give the concept of a moral law, whether natural or revealed, that give the notion of law a central role, they naturally emphasize the prohibitive aspects of morality, the listing of kinds of actions to be altogether avoided. After all, most of the Ten Commandments begin with "thou shalt not." And as I've just said, Aristotle believes that there are some actions that are altogether ruled out. But Aristotle doesn't spend a lot of time on them because in his ethical treatises, he's not concentrating on the minimum necessary for moral decency, the minimum you can get away with, as it were. He is, as it were, writing an ethical treatise for an honours degree, not simply a pass degree. He's teaching you how to be ethically excellent. But I think there's one has to look at things from another side as well. There is more to morality than just virtue, but there's also more to virtue than morality. A prime example of a moral virtue for Aristotle is courage. It's one of the four cardinal virtues, both in Plato, in Aristotle, and in Christian tradition. Now, courage is a virtue, but it's needed not just in moral contexts. It's exercised in many non-moral contexts. For instance, in hazardous sports, such as mountaineering. And at a certain age, it takes courage even to mount a ladder to change a bulb. But changing a light bulb, except in special contexts, is not a matter that raises moral issues. But let's return to the non-virtue part of morality rather than the non-moral part of virtue. That is to say, these actions that are ruled out in advance. Many people are suspicious of the idea that some classes of actions are absolutely prohibited. They ask, where do these absolute prohibitions come from? Well, religious believers obviously think that they come from God. But religious believers don't actually seem to be able to reach agreement among themselves as to which are the things that are absolutely prohibited by God, at least on the fringe. And even if they did, how would they convince unbelievers of this? On the other hand, can there be an absolute prohibition without somebody to prohibit it? Well, Aristotle believed that they could because As I've said, he lists things that are absolutely ruled out. But he also says explicitly that God does not issue commands. Well, I think that the answer to this question, where do these prohibitions come from, is to be found in the nature of morality itself. And I want to sketch very briefly indeed a theory of what morality is. I think that there are three things necessary for a morality. There has to be a moral community. There have to be moral values, and there have to be a moral code. All three of these things, in my view, are essential to a moral system, and I want to say a little bit about each of them. First, the need for a moral community. I think it is as impossible to have a purely private morality as it is to have a purely private language. Many of you will be familiar with Wittgenstein's argument, which in my view is decisive, that there cannot be such a thing as a purely private language. That is to say, a language which referred only to entities that are private to individuals. Now, I think that it's impossible to have a purely private morality. That's the first point. Secondly, the moral life of a community consists in the shared pursuit of non-material values, such as fairness, truth, comradeship, freedom. It is the nature of the values pursued by the community that distinguishes morality from economics. And thirdly, this pursuit is carried out within a framework which excludes certain prohibited types of behavior. That's the code element. And it's that which distinguishes morality from aesthetics, which is also a pursuit of non-material values, but in which there is no code prohibiting certain forms of aesthetic expression. Now, the answer to the question, who does the prohibiting, is that it is the members of the moral community. Membership of a common moral society involves subscription to a common code. And I want to go on now to fill out these three points of the community, the values, and the code. Philippa Foote developed her moral philosophy largely in opposition to the then dominant prescriptivism of people like Richard Hare. For Hare, the moral legislator was essentially an individual. Hare, taking inspiration from Kant and using the Kantian principle of universalizability as the lever to generate moral judgments. All that was needed for a moral judgment, according to Hare, was that the individual should have a prescription, should prescribe to himself and others something that was universalizable, could be applied to everybody. There was no restriction for Hare on the content of the prescription, and there was no need for anybody else to concur in the judgment. The only logical requirement on the moral agent was that his total prescriptions, the totality of his prescriptions, should be consistent. Now, of course, the prescription was applicable, the rule applied to people other than the person doing the prescribing. That was what was meant by universalizability. But it applied hypothetically to other individuals in the same circumstances as the person prescribing. But whether anybody was ever, in fact, in those circumstances was a matter irrelevant. And in that sense, one could say that a morality of Hare's type was a private morality. I've said that it was as impossible to have a purely private morality as it is to have a purely private language, and for similar reasons. Wittgenstein argued that it was impossible to give meaning to a word by a private ostensive definition, a kind of inner look at one's self, because with such a procedure there would be no difference between seeming right and being right, that is to say, one's conception of the meaning of a word being right and seeming right. And so too, I think, with a private morality. An individual's sincere moral principles cannot be faulted by any other individual. And so, on this system of morality, for the prescriber, for the person prescribing, there's no difference between being right and seeming right. For there to be a morality, then, there has to be a moral community. And moral communities are not put together by individual choice. We are all born and brought up within moral communities. To use a Kantian metaphor, we are not volunteers, but conscripts in the kingdom of ends. But it's by no means an uncontroversial matter to determine what the extent is of the moral community to which one belongs. Should we say the whole human race? Well, there have been many times and places in which the effective moral community was much smaller than this. The inhabitants of a city, the members of a tribe, the citizens of a nation. The Stoics had an interesting view on this question of the extent of the moral community. They said that each of us is in the middle of a series of concentric circles. The first circle surrounding my individual soul contains my body and its needs. The second contains my immediate family, and the third and fourth contain extensions of my family. Then there come circles of neighbors at varying distances, plus the circle which consists of all the people that belong to the same nation as myself. The largest, the ultimate concentric circle, does contain the whole human race. Now, if I'm virtuous, what I try to do is to draw these circles closer together, treating my cousins if they were my brothers, and constantly transferring people from distant circles to friendly circles. It's a process they called oikiosis, a kind of making people part of your home. The Stoic who propounded this account, a man called Heracles, he was writing just a few years after Jesus had preached that the neighbor whom I should love as I love myself could belong to a different tribe or group or nation. And since the time of Montaigne, people have extended the moral community beyond humankind to other sentient beings, claiming that animals have equal claim with human beings. I mentioned this in connection with Bentham, saying that because he made the supreme moral criterion a matter of sensation, it was made sense to treat animals as well as ourselves as part of the moral community. But of course, those earlier moralists and some later ones who placed supreme moral value in the activities of the reason regarded non-rational animals as standing outside the moral community. And in the Christian tradition, which I agree with, only those can have rights who have duties, and animals don't. A good dog has virtues of its own, but they're not moral virtues. So much for my first point, namely the moral community as an essential element for a morality. I went on to say that the moral life of the community consists in the shared pursuit of non-material values, things like fairness, truth, comradeship, and so on. I said that it was the nature of the values pursued that distinguished morality from economics. But the individual values are not pursued in isolation from each other. The pursuit of these values is the same thing as the exercise of the moral virtues, and these virtues form a unity. The several values are pursued as elements of a good life. Here is the relation to happiness for the individual and the community. It is in tying together the moral values that the notion of happiness plays a crucial role in morality. My third point was that the exercise of the virtues, the pursuit of the non-material goods, was carried out within a framework that excludes certain prohibited types of behavior. And it was this, I said, which distinguished morality from aesthetics, which is also a pursuit of non-material values such as beauty. And I said these prohibitions that they do not, in my view, need to emanate from a source external to the community, such as a transcendent God. I suggest that the moral community creates moral laws in a manner similar to that in which the linguistic community creates the rules of grammar and syntax. Moral rules, like the rules of grammar and syntax, may change as society changes. But without a set of such rules, society collapses into anarchy in the same way as language collapses into incoherence. Now, even the most devout people, I think, don't believe that God promulgates linguistic rules in the way in which they believe he promulgates moral commands. In Genesis, God teaches Adam the names of the animals, or rather encourages Adam to name the animals. But even the Bible doesn't suggest that God taught Adam grammar and syntax. And even if Chomsky is right, that there are innate constraints on the kind of languages there can be. The most that God has written in our hearts is the rules of depth grammar, the linguistic laws that we obey whenever we speak have their origin in ourselves, in our community. The idea that moral rules originate with the moral community itself was picturesquely sketched by Immanuel Kant. Every human being, he said, is a member of a kingdom of ends, a union of rational beings under common laws. My own will is rational only insofar as its maxims, that is to say, the principles on which we make our choices, are capable of being made universal laws. And the converse of this is that universal law is a law that is made by rational wills like my own. A rational being is, quote, subject to laws which are made by himself and yet are universal, unquote. That's a quote from Kant. Now, in the kingdom of ends, we are all both legislators and subjects. Kant left room for a divine being who was not just a member, but a head of the kingdom of ends, a legislator not subject to law. And no doubt it was pious and prudent for him to do so. But if I'm right, it was not actually a necessary part of his system. Instead of a kingdom of ends, I think we can make sense of a republic of ends, in which the members are citizens rather than subjects. Such a republic is a direct democracy, not a representative democracy. All of us are legislators, and no one is above the law. And I'd like to... that we've now reached the end of 18, and I'd like to stop there for discussion before my final account of what I see are the constituents of happiness and what is their relation to morality. So, are you all convinced by my account that there can be absolute moral prohibitions originating only in a community, whether or not there is a God? Well, the analogy with language seems to me quite persuasive, that clearly there is no external legislator laying down the laws of language. And equally, I think there can be moral laws without an external legislator. I once had an experience which brought home to me the kind of Kantian nature of linguistic rules in the sense of being both a legislator and a subject. I was invited by Oxford University Press to a party celebrating the publication of the two-volume shorter Oxford Dictionary. I was very puzzled as to why I had been invited to the launch of this dictionary, because I hadn't had any part in making it. And when I got to the party, I discovered that everybody else was equally puzzled. None of us knew why we had been invited. At the end of the party, however, we were each given an envelope. And the envelope contained a list of the words in the dictionary for which a passage of our writing had been quoted as the authority. Because, of course, they bring they cite various passages of people's writings. At first, my reaction, of course, was enormous pride. I fancy my writing being important enough to be quoted in a dictionary. And then I began to feel a bit like, you remember Groucho Marx saying, who would want to be a member of a club that has members like me? It was the feeling, well, you know, if the only evidence they can give for the meaning of the word is the likes of me, why should I bother about the dictionary? But then my third reaction was to think, well, it is just as Kant says. I am a legislator because I'm quoted in the dictionary, but I am also a subject of the dictionary. I can't go using words in a sense that are totally different from what it says in the dictionary. And so I think I take that as an analogy from the way in which each member of the moral community is both a legislator and is also a subject. Well, in the last half hour, let me go back to the topic where we started, happiness as measured by the pollsters who go round saying on a scale of 1 to 7, from misery to happiness, where do you place yourself? And I began by asking, how seriously should we take all this? And concluded that this was really only captured one strand of happiness. It may be perhaps the major strand in modern words like happiness and their equivalent in other languages. But if one wants to relate it to the happiness that has been described over the centuries by the great philosophers, I think you have to add some other things. Because of, as I mentioned, in post-Benthamite philosophy, the topic of happiness was handed over, for a while at least, to the economists. I decided to write my own book about happiness in conjunction with my son Charles, who was then an economist at the World Bank. I think our joint book appeared on the reading list. We wrote this book together in alternate chapters. I wrote the philosophical chapters, and Charles wrote the wrote the economics chapters. We wrote a lot of the book quite near here in Bellagio, in the Rockefeller Institute there, which is set up for collaborative ventures like that. It was a very happy time indeed, I have to say. And we came to the conclusion that in happiness, considered as a goal for economic policy and for moral activity, there were three separable elements. There was welfare, there was contentment, and there was dignity. Now, the easiest of these to describe and to quantify is welfare, in the most obvious sense of material welfare. This consists in the satisfaction of one's animal needs for food, drink, shelter, and the other things that conduce to bodily flourishing. Now, in assigning, in measuring the welfare of individuals, you don't have to depend on their answers to questionnaires. People can be quite mistaken about the state of their bodily health. Other people are often much better placed than I am to make a judgment about my bodily welfare. Welfare is the least controversial element in well-being, and almost all philosophers who've considered the topic have regarded welfare, that is the possession of bodily goods, as either a constituent or, more often, a necessary condition, a precondition for happiness. In addition to material welfare, there is psychological welfare, which is less easy to quantify, though it can be quantified. I mean, there are negative conditions necessary for well-being, freedom from mental illness or defect, and freedom from tragedies occurring within one's family or immediate social circle. But there are also positive abilities of a mental as well as a physical kind, which may well be regarded as basic constituents of a good life. Literacy is a good whose possessors prize in themselves and wish to confer on others. But perhaps things like education and literacy, which incidentally are quite measurable, are not so much an element in welfare as the third element of well-being, which I called dignity. Now, contentment, what I have called contentment, is the one which is most easily measurable by the results of the opinion polls. One can say that opinion polls do give a reasonable assessment of how contented the members of a community are. Of course, there are all the snags that I mentioned early yesterday in evaluating the answers to the questions, and people may change their minds and so on. But I think this doesn't mean that the self-ascribed well-being, which is what they use as the technical term for the results of these, is something that is totally to be disregarded. After all, we make use of opinion polls about things like people's voting intentions in making political predictions. And I think that one can, to some extent, make use of the results of happiness polls in deciding on social and political arrangements. And, of course, it was interesting that the conclusions of the polls suggesting that above a certain minimum level there is very little correlation between riches and contentment is very much in line with a philosophical tradition going back to Plato, Aristotle, and the Stoics. Now, the third element, dignity, is a much more complicated notion to define. We can, I suppose, begin by saying that dignity involves the control of one's own destiny and the ability to live a life of one's choice. But in addition, it seems to be necessary for real well-being that one's chosen way of life should have some worth in itself and should enjoy the respect of others. And because dignity concerns not only things internal to oneself, but also one's position in relationship to others, measurements of dignity cannot be as absolute and objective as measurements of welfare. And dignity is the element of well-being that is most emphasized in the eudaimonistic tradition of ethics that we considered yesterday. Now, these three elements, welfare, contentment, and dignity, are independent of each other, and they can vary independently. Each can exist without the others, and parts of the triad may occur without the third, pairs of the triad. And it's possible for somebody to have welfare and contentment without dignity. A well-housed and well-fed slave who looks for nothing better than his servile life and has no complaints about the way he's treated may be thought of being, in a certain sense, quite happy, but he lacks the dignity that only liberty could confer. As Bernard Williams once put it, the fact that people are contented with their lot does not mean that their lot is as it should be. Contentment and dignity, on the other hand, may be present without welfare. A devout and ascetic hermit, revered by all who come in contact with him, may well regard himself as blessed, even though he may be undernourished and unhealthy. If we look for a secular example, we may think of hunger strikers, admired by a throng of supporters, suffering resolutely to further a political cause they believe in. During a large part of my life, there were such hunger strikers in Northern Ireland who had contentment and a kind of strange form of dignity while being of their own choice extremely undernourished. And both religious and secular martyrs have died proclaiming their happiness. And of course, it's all too easy to take the final alternative. It's all too easy for welfare and elements of dignity to be present without contentment, as in the case of a bored and pampered member of some rich and prosperous elite. Many of the problems and paradoxes that have perplexed those who've sought to understand the nature of happiness can be removed if we resolve it into these three separate elements and consider them in turn. Now, the purpose that my son and I had in breaking down the notion of well-being was not to show that nobody can be happy who doesn't score highly in each of these dimensions. Throughout history, few people have been fortunate enough to be in possession of all the desirable characteristics we've identified. But the purpose of the analysis, because we were concerned with public policy, was to show that when we pursue happiness for ourselves or for others, that it isn't a simple, uniform goal. It's a complex goal, and if we're trying to measure well-being, a single metric won't suffice. And policies for the maximization of happiness may involve trade-offs between dignity and contentment, or between welfare and dignity, or between contentment and welfare. Now, the three items that I've identified correspond to the inalienable human rights, whose existence was affirmed in the American Declaration of Independence, where they said that it was a self-evident truth that everybody had the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, life, broadly interpreted, includes the necessaries that I have called welfare. Liberty is the foundation of a career of dignity. And the happiness that was to be pursued was conceived by the founding fathers as a time of contentment, such as was soon to be given the name utility. And for that reason, Charles and I called our book Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Utility. And that's really all I have to say about the nature of happiness and its relation to morality. I leave the rest of the time for you to make points.
I have to pay the question. Because dignity is something that can be translated into dignitaries. That is the people that for one reason or another, they can produce welfare and contents with dignity for the other people. Now, in the modern context, the dignitaries are no more producing welfare and contents for other people than from themselves. And that's where you have to make a link in between dignity and welfare. Because if you are, by culture or power or whatever, in a position to produce welfare and contents, you have to do this with the most moral happiness that you may find in the result of that. But if you are a dignitary and you produce dignity and welfare and content only for yourself, then the road is going far apart from happiness for everybody.
Happiness for everybody has to be got to involve all three of the elements for everybody. That's why a master cannot simply point to the fact that his slaves are well fed and contented, because they do not have dignity, because they do not control their own destiny. Now, I think you said something at the beginning about dignity being what dignitaries have. But if a dignitary is somebody who is in a position of power in a state, that is only one form of dignity, and I think the least important. I mean, I think if, insofar as a special dignity is to be conferred on special officials, it is because the job that they are to do is one which affects the welfare of the whole nation. Whether or not they live up to the demands of this job is, of course, another matter. But I think that the dignity has become a more important political and legal concept in recent years as a result of recent history. The first German constitution after the war, I think, contained a right to dignity as well as other human rights. And this was, of course, because of the horrendous history of the way in which the Jews lost not only life and possessions, but also dignity. And when the new South African constitution was drawn up at the end of apartheid, following the German example, they also inserted a right to dignity among the human rights, because, of course, under apartheid, the blacks had not been treated with equal dignity. And I think that as it becomes easier to satisfy the welfare conditions, and there's no doubt that in spite of there being terrible pockets of poverty around the world, the average welfare has increased a lot over the last 20 years. Once that it's easier to satisfy the welfare requirements of citizens, then their status as dignified or not is much more closely related to their contentment than their welfare is. And the that's where I think a very important element, which I said was on the borderline between welfare and dignity, is the question of education and literacy. For instance, the countries where it is not permissible for women to be educated or to be educated beyond a basic level. Clearly that is an affront both to the welfare and to the dignity of women. One sees that in the classes of those who have been oppressed, whether slaves or wanderers or women or other minorities, there is always this procession, I think, first seeking welfare and then seeking dignity. And one has to look to the future for a time when welfare, contentment and dignity would be universally available around the world.
The Holy Spirit, because it's too human to reduct the dignities to human workers or to the apartheid work or to the other thing. A prophet can be a dignitary. An artist can be a dignitary. A teacher can be a dignitary.
So it's not dignity as in dignitary that I'm thinking of. It
no,
is not.
To say that dignity is something that is like trust. I mean, it's something that is not to put under discussion in any field, not only in one part of the human being, in the whole context of the human being.
Exactly. I said that the key item in dignity was control of one's own destiny so far as is possible for human beings, and the choice of one's own way of life. Now, unlike Aristotle, I don't want to say that there's only one way of life that is utterly dignified and utterly contented, namely philosophy. I do think that the pursuit of philosophy is a dignified and happy-making activity. It, an important element in happiness is in dignity is, of course, religious freedom, and there are many religious activities which are dignified and providing contentment, and this can be accepted by people whether or not they accept the religion. I have been, and my son and I in our book, we were anxious to give an account of happiness that would make sense for people whether or not they were religious, because we wanted it to be something that could be taken into account as a basis for policy makers. Whereas if you import any particular religious element in it, then, of course, particularly in the United States, they will say it is violating the distinction between church and state. But we didn't want to exclude it at all, even though we were leaving it out of our consideration. Did you have a question, please?
Thank you, Professor, for your delivery. Thanks for your delivery.
Thank you.
I'm looking at the three elements that you put up. The welfare, the commitment, and the dignity.
Yeah.
More with the Maslow pyramid, about first you talk about the welfare as the precondition.
Yeah.
It's more like the basic needs, the material needs, and psychology, and then the dignity, more with self-realization of the human person, that's the dignity. Can you put them in steps? Welfare, contentment, and dignity.
Can I put them in a set?
Set in a pyramid form.
Yes, I see what you mean. I think that welfare is the it's the a necessary element, but the least important element of a happy life. I think that dignity is, I think, more important than contentment. And I was giving the example of martyrs, of prisoners for a cause, and so on, who have dignity without while sacrificing contentment. But I don't really want. I don't think they should be put in an order, because I think that they are. For a completely happy life, you need them all. And I think, as I expounded, that they can, one of them can exist without the other two, and pairs can exist without the third. And I don't, if they were to be put, as it were, in a pyramid, then that would suggest a single metric of happiness, which was one of the things I was very much against. I think that policymakers must realize that there isn't just a single measure of happiness, and therefore any policy choices are going to involve trade-offs between one and the other. Yes,
I would like to go back to the moral community.
Mm-hmm.
You said that, if I understood well, you said that the morality is made by the
community, by the members of the community, yeah.
Whether there's a belief in God or
yeah.
not in
mm-hmm.
that community.
Yeah.
So do you think that it can never be really universal? Morality can never be universal in that case, because if it's the community that sets up the mm-hmm. rules for morality, then there are communities where there are minorities without dignity
mm-hmm.
that cannot get to a universal morality ever. Is that true?
I think that it was for this reason that I introduced the Stoic notion of the concentric circles. I think that the ideal is a moral community that is coterminous with the human race. And I think we have been striving to do that. I mean, organizations like the United Nations have been trying to collect a set of values and so on, and also a set of prohibitions that are subscribed to, at least in theory, by the entire human race. And if so, then that would be a universal morality. In answer to your question, though, I would say universality has to be the goal of any moral community, but at any given time it will probably not have been achieved. There will be, say the values about things like female education are not universally shared, but we think they should be.
Yeah, but, sorry to interrupt, ecology is one word that was melted together when I was 12 or 14. So there was not even the concept of ecology in the moral status of mm-hmm. Somebody like me when I was 8 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
So, and ecology is one of the biggest issues about morality in the modern world. Apart that, if I think myself when I was 12 in a swimming pool or in a beach, morality compared to what I see in the sea today is totally different. So, is also very much linked to time and weather, the morality of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Culture and time, the progress everybody does in time.
That was something that I said earlier, that I said moral prohibitions may change over time in the way that language changes over time. But that unless there are some absolute at any given time, in a community which may or may not be the whole human race, unless there are some absolutes, the community will implode, in the same way as unless there are some rules of grammar and syntax and meaning, everything collapses into chaos, linguistic chaos, rather than moral chaos. Please.
To which extent your view about happiness does have any similarity with Rawls' one?
With Rawls?
Yeah, about the lens of life and so on.
Rawls's view, I think, depends too much on the thought experiment of if you were ignorant of what race, society, or class you're going to belong to, what rules would you accept? I find that it is a complete unreality to imagine that you could have a personal individuality to make you a moral judge prior to all these things. I think of course, he admits that it is a thought experiment, but I think that it is too biased in favor of an American rights-based approach to morality, rather than the kind of law-based approach to morality which Anscombe and Geach and so on were proposing. But I find Rawls very complicated actually to discuss.